Bible, the book of Romans in the New Testament. We touched on it earlier in the year. We're going to, I hope, work through much of it in the course of this year. And today, perhaps, a chance to anticipate some selected sections of the book of Romans. So we pray, Heavenly Father, that as we read this book that brings home your grace to us so clearly, that you'd help us to grasp and understand and to take in a little more of that wondrous, special, choosing love that you bestow upon your children. Amen. And we begin in chapter 1 with the reading, which is our text verse to inspire us for this coming year. Romans chapter 1, verse 16. I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. First for the Jew, then for the Gentile. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. Now let me ask you, what is your earliest memory in life? It's quite hard to be specific, isn't it? When you get back into your very early childhood, you tend to get more of sort of vague impressions rather than lots of specific memories. And you never quite know whether you're really remembering an event or whether you're imagining it, having someone else having told you it later. My earliest memory, I think, is of being saved from the sea as a toddler. Now, my parents maintain that I was far too young to recall it, but I'm pretty sure I can. I wouldn't have been much more than 18 months old. It was a family trip to the beach. We were with relatives paddling in the water. And it was one of those typical moments that often happen in families where there are lots of adults around and everyone is assuming that someone else is watching the baby. And suddenly, everyone realized that no one was watching me. And indeed, nobody could see me at all. Now you can imagine the frantic shouting and the splashing around in the water as everybody frantically looked for me. And then my uncle spots a little shape just beneath the surface, reaches down and hauls me out, coughing and spluttering. Now they think that I'd been underwater for at least a minute. Now I'm pretty sure it must have felt longer to them than it really was. Anyway, no harm done in the end to my brain. And I've got a good story to tell. Many things are worth it for the story. Because the earliest memory of life for me is of a hand reaching down through the murky water above and grabbing me by the t-shirt and hauling me out, followed by some very unpleasant coughing and retching and spluttering on the beach. So I reckon, anyway, unless I am imagining it, having been told the story. But I like to think that's my first memory. Because then it means that my earliest memory of earthly life is uncannily similar to my earliest memory of Christian life, doesn't it? Of course, it's different in some ways. I was rather older when I became a Christian. I can remember events that went before my faith. And it wasn't at the beach. It wasn't half as dramatic or frightening, and my uncle wasn't involved. But in its essential nature, it was the same. I was lost, drowning in my sins, if you like. And I was only dimly aware of the danger I was in, but utterly helpless, certain to die, as certain as a toddler underwater. But God was looking for me. And he found me. And the hand of God himself reached down through the murk of my life and saved me. And it's only much later, as I learn more, that I can even start to appreciate the significance of that event. And I hope and I trust that many of us here, all of us here, know that same salvation too. Now, the hand of grace with which God saved me, and I trust saves you and saves anyone, the hand is that hand of God's grace. And that grace is revealed in the gospel of Jesus Christ, a good news story about him. And that's the aspect of the greatness of God which we are looking at in the gospel tonight. And our key verse, as I said, is the one from the start of the year. And if you haven't learned this by now, then you better, because we're going to test you before long. And we anticipate in it, as I say, some of the things that we're going to discover in the book of Romans in more depth later on in the year. Now, we've already seen, let me remind you, the gospel shows us God's goodness, his general attitude of goodwill towards all creatures, because he offers this salvation to all. We've also seen his grief and our sinfulness, and that grief ultimately must resolve either into divine wrath and judgment or into salvation for us. Tonight we get about as close as we can to God's own beating heart. What is it that actually saves people? It's his grace. Grace is one of those words, of course, that Christians bandy around without sometimes pausing to think what it means. For ourselves alone, wondering whether other people are ever going to understand it. After all, we go around saying God's grace to people. Most people will think that you mean that God is a ballerina, won't they? Because ballerinas are graceful, aren't they? Or maybe they'll think of you saying grace after a meal or something like that. So we have to be careful to actually explain what we mean by grace. Maybe you remember the Sunday school definitions. They're quite helpful. God's riches at Christ's expense. Or mercy is when God does not give us the things we do deserve. Grace is when God gives us the things we don't deserve. And these are helpful. They start to get near the heart of it. The essential idea in grace is the idea of unmerited favour. God showing his goodness to those who don't in any sense at all, no sense whatsoever, deserve that goodness. Now, of course, that definition covers that general goodness of God, that common grace to everyone that we discussed a fortnight ago. Tonight, we are focusing on the aspect of grace that actually saves us from the mess that we're in. And this is sometimes called special grace by theologians. And this grace is perhaps the jewel in the crown of the Christian faith, the Christian gospel. My hope tonight is to let the light of the gospel shine and reflect on some of the faces of the diamond. Don't worry if some of the things I say go over your head, because I'm going to try and stretch those of us who are familiar with these things. But hang on to a particular point of God's grace tonight and take it home with you, won't you? Now, there are four angles we'll look at it. The gospel reveals God's grace in his initiative, in his justice, his justification, explain that in a moment, in his choice of us, and in his power to save us. And the key idea we're upholding all the way through is that in every respect, all of this salvation comes from God. That's what grace means. It's all of God coming to us. So we start with God's initiative. You see, when I was lost underwater, my relatives didn't wait for me to ask for help. They didn't expect me to stick up my head and shout, "Mum, Dad, Uncle." They weren't looking for a chubby little arm to come out. "Help, help, save me." They weren't waiting for a signal flare or a call on the mobile phone. An underwater toddler cannot do any of those things. In fact, an underwater toddler doesn't really understand what's happening to him at all. If my memory serves me correctly, I don't particularly remember any great fear while under the water, sort of blobbing around. It was kind of peaceful, really. I wouldn't feel like that now as an adult, I think. So I'm very glad that they took the initiative to find me and save me without respecting my human rights to self-determination in the matter. If they'd left it to my initiative, I would not be here now. So the first aspect of grace that we should see in the gospel is that God has taken the initiative in our salvation. The gospel is the story of what God has already done, planned and executed on our behalf. Salvation isn't merely God's kind response to our requests, is it? It's his idea in the first place. It begins with him. Now, of course, the Bible is full of instances where God's mercy is shown as a response to those who ask for it, to those who plead for it. Think, for example, of the Israelites groaning in slavery in Egypt, or the prayers of David, the Psalms of David, asking for deliverance from some great crisis. Of course, God does respond to those situations. But we need to understand that those cries for mercy and God's responding to them in that way are already set within the context of God's special grace. Do you see what I mean? Those people are crying out to God in the Bible in that way because they're already in the covenant, if you like, the special arrangement with God. They already benefit from God's special grace to them, from the initiatives that he already took to the Israelites and to David and to the other people towards them. Do you see? So God does respond to the cries of those who are already within his love. But if you take a step back, look at the point where salvation itself begins, and you see it always begins in every respect with him and not with us. The Bible's clear that by ourselves we don't even ask or seek for mercy. We can't. We don't even know we're in trouble half the time. The good news is not simply, if you turn to God, he'll respond. The good news is that before you even give him a thought, before you even realize your danger or want him to do anything, God has already taken the initiative towards us. We'll find this particularly clearly when we get to Romans chapter 5, won't we? Turn to Romans chapter 5. To whet your appetite, verses 6 to 8. You see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous man, though for a good man someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. While we're still powerless, while we're still sinners, while there's nothing we can do, he does it. So even if, in your experience, your earliest memory of being a Christian is of your crying out to God in some crisis situation that you were in and finding that he answered you, you need to realize that, in fact, his grace to you came first. And you've simply forgotten it in the mists of time. The idea of your salvation was conceived before the atoms that make up your body were even created. The provision that he made for your salvation was worked out 2,000 years before you were even born. And the impetus for your salvation, the very fact that you sought help from God at all, was all because his grace worked beforehand to enable you to do it. So the gospel reveals God's grace in the initiative he takes to save us. Okay? Second side to the diamond. And this is what I've called God's justice, or God's justification, in his forgiveness. Now I'll try and explain this, you see. You see, the problem is not just that we can't do anything to help ourselves. The problem isn't just ability. The problem is that we're not worthy to be saved. The problem is our sinfulness. And here the reality of God's grace goes far deeper than the efforts made by my uncle. After all, as a toddler, I wasn't able to help myself, but you wouldn't say that I wasn't worthy to be saved, would you? I mean, I was sort of cute and cuddly and, you know, about as innocent as any person could get. It wasn't even as if I was being naughty to be underwater. It was their fault. And even if I had been naughty, you'd be pretty harsh to say that drowning was my just deserts, wouldn't you? It wasn't hard for them to be looking for me because they loved me, and I was a sweet little boy in their eyes then. The gospel shows us, though, that God's love, God's grace, is towards sinners who really do deserve the mess they're in, and nothing else in life. Forgiveness poses us many dilemmas, doesn't it? as human beings, to put it into practice. We saw an incredible example of human forgiveness late last year with the family of Anthony Walker. Remember him? He was that young black Christian brutally murdered in a racist attack in Liverpool. Now, his mother had every justification to be filled with rage towards his murderers and to cry for justice for her son. Yet she publicly forgave her son's murderers. Anthony spent his life forgiving, she said. His life stood for peace, love, and forgiveness, and I brought them up that way. I have to practice what I preach. I don't feel any bitterness towards them, really, truly. All I feel is, I feel sad for the family, she said. And we must admire her, mustn't we? We must be inspired by her. We must respect her. But what would you think if the judge in the trial had said that? What would you think if the judge, as he passed sentence, said something like this? Anthony spent his life forgiving. His life stood for peace, love, and forgiveness. Therefore, I'm going to forgive you too and give you a suspended sentence. You may go free. Would that impress us, please us, delight us? Would it delight Mrs. Walker? No. That would be wrong. We might admire Mrs. Walker's gracious personal attitude. We must admire it. But the duty of the judge is to pass the sentence that the criminals deserve. And if he doesn't, we feel rightly outraged. He's let us all down. Perhaps the only way we could conceive of where the judge might have the moral right to let those prisoners walk is if Mrs. Walker was the judge. Maybe then it would be all right. But you know, I don't even think that would do, would it? Because a judge has to act on behalf of the law itself and behalf of wider society as well. They don't deserve to be released. So quite rightly in our society, you see, we have to separate, don't we, the roles, the duties of legal justice on one hand, which is right and good, and personal forgiveness on the other, which is also right and good. Because for any one human being, it's impossible to combine the two. It's an impossible dilemma. And 99 times out of 100, of course, if the human victim were the judge, the result would not be leniency, would it? 99 times out of 100, the result would be the most savage revenge that the injured person can think of. But we're talking about God here, aren't we? And it's not impossible for God. Not for his divine grace. For God is both the victim, the one injured, should we say, and the judge. He's the one wounded against and the one who upholds the law. And the miracle of his grace is how he resolves that dilemma, as it were, a dilemma for us, but not for him, of justice and mercy, and brings them together. Because of his great loving passion for us, he provides a way to forgive us that is right and fair. Not just a judge letting them go free, but fairly and rightly letting them go free. God sends Christ to die in our place, his own son, so that our offences against him aren't merely forgotten, swept under the carpet, but fully and completely looked square on, seen for what they are, condemned, punished, and paid for, never to be resurrected again. Justice is completely satisfied. And he can do that because it's his justice. And he's bearing the grief that his justice entails. And so we're not merely criminals let off the hook. That's not the good news. The good news is that you can be acquitted, innocent altogether, in God's eyes. That's the miracle of justification, isn't it? That's the theological word. And it says in these verses in verse 16 that in the gospel, a righteousness of God is revealed that is by truth. Righteousness, that is a conformity to what is good and right, given to us from God. The greatness of God's grace in the gospel is it provides a way to combine that wonderful personal forgiveness of Mrs. Walker with the impartial fairness of a perfect judge. And to do so a million times over for a million people. Now, as we work through Romans, we're going to find this dimension of God's grace explained particularly in chapter 3. Turn on to that and see a few verses that point this out to us. Verse 21. But now a righteousness from God, apart from law, has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. This righteousness from God, this righteous status from God, comes through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There is no difference, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Jesus Christ. God presented him as a sacrifice of atonement through faith in his blood. He did this to demonstrate his justice, because in his forbearance he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. He did it to demonstrate his justice at the present time, so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus Christ, faith in Jesus. Now, of course, there's quite a mouthful in there, lots crammed in, and I'll aim to explain it when we get there. But the upshot of all of this is that if you've been forgiven by God's grace, no one can question whether it's right or fair that he's done so. Not you, not others, not the devil. No one can say, you don't deserve it. Well, actually, no, they can, can't they? That's the point. Everyone can say, you don't deserve it. Let them say it all they like, because it's true. That's the whole point. You don't deserve it. You don't deserve it any more than Anthony's murderers deserve the comfort of Anthony's mother's forgiveness. But the grace of God is to forgive sinners, people who don't deserve it, but to forgive us validly, if you like, fairly, justly, without any compromise on his part. So God's grace is seen in his initiative to save us when we're helpless, and his sacrifice to justify us when we're unworthy. But who exactly is the us that we're talking about? Where we bring our little contribution into the equation? Well, no, I'm going to argue. The identity of the us is God's grace too. Grace is revealed in God's choice, in salvation. Now, previously, we've emphasized that the gospel is a genuinely offered, a genuine offer of salvation to anyone who hears it. It's an expression of God's genuine open-heartedness to all. And you can say to anyone you like that God saves you. And if you put your faith in Jesus, you'll be saved because he loves you. It's inconceivable that anyone could come to Jesus Christ and not be welcome if they did. And quite understandably, when we share the gospel, when we preach the gospel, when we see it summarized in verses in scriptures, it's that openness that tends to come to the fore. It's the power for salvation of everyone who believes, says verse 16 of chapter 1. Yet, as you examine the gospel more deeply, or better still, as you believe the gospel for yourself, you find this truth also. That God's salvation, that the death of Jesus on the cross, that his rising from the dead, were things specifically targeted to you. In his house are many rooms, and one of them has already got your name on it. As Paul puts it very movingly in Galatians chapter 2, I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. Paul found a personal thing, didn't he? He can use the singular pronoun. Or if we want to stick to Romans, as we probably should, chapter 8, verses 29 to 30. Famous words. It'll probably be quite a while before we start getting to chapter 8. Verse 29. Verse 28, sorry. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. For those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the likeness of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those he predestined, he also called. Those he called, he also justified. Those he justified, he also glorified. So the Bible is quite clear that God's grace means that he chooses people. The interesting question is why some are chosen and others aren't. Is it the case, as many of my brothers and sisters would argue, that God chooses who are saved on the basis of what he foresees in us? That he looks into the future, as it were, and he sees that, oh, so-and-so is going to choose to believe, but oh, she over there, she's not going to choose to believe. And then he decides to save them. Now, that's an attractive way of thinking if we want to assert our own free will. At face value, you can read that verse that way. But there are actually quite a few problems with it. First of all, that word translated foresaw there, it doesn't merely mean that he sort of knew beforehand, rather like predicting the result of the derby. It includes the idea of loving and choosing someone beforehand. More like breeding the winner of the derby, or you know what I mean? Secondly, there's problems with the logic of it. How can you foresee something happening and then choose to make it happen without it being you who decided it was going to happen? It just doesn't seem to quite work out. But third, and perhaps connecting most with our theme for tonight, what does that view actually say about our salvation? Doesn't that actually imply that there is some aspect of it that in a real sense starts with us, with me, with you, rather than with God? Doesn't that go against the whole thing that we're talking about grace? If the key choice in the whole matter is ours, then surely if we were like-minded, so minded, we could perhaps even claim to just a little credit for it. Oh yes, God did 99.9% of saving me, but obviously that little 0.1% was very necessary to actually, you know, decide. Strikes me that that is actually against grace, not grace. The Bible itself, if we're willing to swallow these words, is actually absolutely clear where the origin of grace lies. It traces it back as far as we can and then stops. We find that in chapter 9, verses 14 to 18. Not, I suppose, the favourite section of the Bible for many people, but words we need to take on board. Paul is talking about why it is that some people are saved and some aren't. Then he says in verse 14, "What then shall we say? Is God unjust? Not at all. For he says to Moses, 'I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion.' It doesn't depend, therefore, on man's desire, what he wants or chooses, or effort, but on God's mercy." Verse 18, "Therefore God has mercy on whom he wants to have mercy, and he hardens whom he wants to harden." And that's as far back down the chain of cause and effect that the Bible lets us go. It takes us that far and then stops and says, God chooses. And stops. You see? Doesn't go any further. The choice is down to God and not down to anything in us. Unconditional, if you like. Now, if that seems a bit arbitrary to you, then I'll agree. If you and I made decisions like that, then it would seem very arbitrary. But all we can say is that he's God. We're not. And it has to be that way. Because if it isn't that way, the essence of grace is lost. You've still got it coming down to something about us that saves us, rather than something about God. Now, I do fully understand why these verses are hard to swallow. they can feel quite psychologically threatening, can't they? You worry about whether God has chosen you. If not, you're doomed whatever you do, you think? And you worry about whether God has chosen people that you love, whether there's any point at all trying to share Jesus with them. It feels like that those we love and we ourselves would have a lot more chance if the choice was down to us and not to God. Surely then there's a level playing field. Surely you've got much more chance. But actually, that's not true. If it was left to our choice, remember, in actual fact, we're all doomed from the start. Remember how bad sin is. Remember that the surprise, as we read the Bible, is not that anyone is lost. The surprise is that anyone at all is saved. Sin makes us, by nature, enemies of God, with no inclination, nothing within us at all, to be forgiven or to even want to be with him, let alone go to heaven. And so a general offer to all, such as the gospel does make, come and be saved, anyone wants, sounds very democratic. But if that's all God does, it actually doesn't save anybody at all. What wins us to Christ is God's personal seeking out of us. When my family were searching in the water, they weren't merely fishing around for any missing child who happened to be there. They were looking for their little Tommy. Only he would do. If they had known that there were two or three other children lost in the water as well, would they have been looking any harder than if it were just me? No, they wouldn't have looked any harder, because they were already looking for me as hard as any human being conceivably could have done. And if, whilst they were looking for me, they had, by chance, come across some other little boy who had also got lost in the water at that particular time, he would be very pleased, I'm sure. But would they have stopped looking for me and kept him? Never mind, this one will do instead. He'll fill the gap left by our lost son. No, a lost child is not like a lost golf ball, is it? Only the particular one you're looking for will do. And even if the substitute child happened to be prettier or cleverer or better behaved than I was, they would have still kept looking for me. Because that's the kind of love that parents have for their children, isn't it? It's specific and personal and doesn't depend on what they're like. So although I know it's hard to swallow in some ways, don't be repelled by this idea that God's grace is election, is a choice he makes. Because that's what makes his love for us so completely unconditional. In the gospel, you find love that is specific and personal to you. You find that he has chosen to set his love on you from before the foundation of the world. As that famous catchphrase says these days, nothing can make him love you more, nothing can make him love you less. And that's because he made that choice before the foundation of the world. And that's wonderfully freeing. It sets us free. All this time we're laboring to be lovely. Oh, I must be so lovable to make people want to love me, to make God want to love me. And you start hating yourself because you can't really be as lovable as lovely. And then people start loving you and you think you don't deserve it. And you castigate yourself even more. And it's that terrible downward spiral. God's grace takes you out of that completely. Because you know that you're completely and utterly and totally loved because he is such a loving God. And nothing you do can change it. Now, isn't that brilliant? Isn't it brilliant, yeah? Someone said yes, I'm glad. Everyone say yes. Isn't it brilliant? Excellent. God's grace in the gospel. See it in his initiative. See it in his justification. See it in his choice. And say it finally, briefly, in his power. I'm beginning to run out of gas here, so I'm not going to say very much more. But you'll remember that in verse 16, it says the gospel is the power of God for salvation. Now, we sometimes think that the gospel means like a clean break, a fresh start. God sort of picks you up, dusts you down, says, here you go, here's a bit of advice, a helping hand, but now you're on your own. You've got a fresh chance to have a go and make it work this time. No. Salvation isn't something that's happened at the start of your life. Most of the time, salvation in the Bible is at the end. Salvation is what happens in the final judgment, when you suddenly find that your sins are not counted against you, and you're free. So where it says the power of God for salvation, it means the power that gets you to the end of the journey, not just the, what deals with the past and starts you off again. You see? We can't, we would never be able to survive if it weren't for the fact that in the gospel there is the power. Romans 8, 9 to 11. This is how the power works. Where are we now? You, however, are controlled now by the Spirit, by the sinful nature, but by the Spirit, if the Spirit of God lives in you. And if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he does not belong to Christ. But if Christ is in you, your body is dead because of Spirit, yet your spirit is alive because of righteousness. And if Christ is if him who raised Jesus from the dead is living in you, you who raised Christ from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies through Christ his Spirit who lives in you.